Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is May 31st. Misleading title. The person I'm going to be talking to today, Lior Gantz, is not a teenager. He's now in his 30s, but he was once. And that was when he started working. He started working at 13 years old, started investing at 16. And instead of going to college, he became an entrepreneur. I've actually done a series of conversations with entrepreneurs and investors like Lior, looking for people who are on the younger side. And quite honestly, I've been trying to ingratiate myself with the entrepreneurial and investing podcast community and to pollinate it. And of course, I'm using pollinate metaphorically. I'm actually not even capable of any form of biotic pollination. I don't have a scopa. My body doesn't have the right electrostatic charge. I actually find the process of carrying pollen grains from the anther of one flower to the receptive carpel of another to be kind of tedious. So I'm using pollinate metaphorically, but yeah, pollinate the entrepreneur podcast community as much as I can with the ideas of deschooling. I think this is a missing piece for a lot of people who are interested in, you know, going out and starting their own entrepreneurial pursuits. But they're still stricken with a schooled mindset and the negative self-talk that it brings. This is a problem that I still struggle with in many ways myself. So best thing to do is to talk about it. I wanted to do that with people from a different world, people who think very, very differently than I do. So I'm doing an interview on a show tomorrow called Crush the Streets, which I am totally going to steal and use as the title for my first rap album. But there's a network of these gentlemen who all work together doing financial news, podcasting, YouTube channels. My producer, Mike, who's been working with us for a few months now, he's done a great job. He's responsible for just about every interview you've heard, maybe since March. He connected me with these guys, and we set up discussions, and I really like how they've gone so far. I've learned a lot of cool stuff, like apparently I'm better off financially than over 80% of people in the United States. So, yeah, get off my lawn, if you know what I mean. I also think it's interesting to pause our other series right now and offer up this juxtaposition between kind of critical, negative, and in many ways destructive thinking that we've been exploring in that series with innovative and productive thinking. I also know, watching the price of Bitcoin and Ethereum, that a lot of you are now rich, and maybe you're looking for a little investment advice. And Lior is a great resource for that as well. I wanted to focus this conversation that ran double the length I intended it to. I wanted to focus it on mindset. Lior, on his site, Wealth Research Group, has a lot of really impactful things to say about the right mindset for entrepreneurs and investors. And that was, you know, pretty much going to be the bulk of the show. I wanted to do a couple of value builders and talk a little bit about investment advice and some shenanigans in the silver market, especially since a lot of us are holding, at this point, maybe some significant amounts of silver. I know I've been at it for about 10 years. I was surprised to learn about some of the schemes that are going on that might be affecting my holdings. But this latter part of the conversation on investing and precious metals wound up being a much more significant portion of the conversation than I originally intended, but that is fine. So the show starts a little slow as Lior and I are getting to know each other, but it really picks up and there's a lot of really valuable information packed into these 80 minutes. So thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you again very soon. We'll be resuming the Above the Snowflake series in just a few days. The conversation I had with a professor from the University of Texas, a philosophy professor, Dr. Daniel Bonavec, about postmodernism, Jacques Derrida, and his idea of deconstruction, which turned out to be a way bigger undertaking, still in progress, by the way, than I initially imagined it would be. So stay tuned, everybody. Thanks for listening and take care. I like your style, and I wanted to focus on some of the things that I think are overlap between, you know, your site or the Wealth Research Group and what we do at School Sucks. We see this as like a huge blind spot. Like, obviously, people get no financial or entrepreneurial education. And I'm going to say all this in the show once we get started. But I'd like to hear, you know, your story. I know you started working when you were very young. You started investing when you were very young. What inspired you to do that? And what were the tools you used to do that at such a young age? And maybe go into the self-knowledge aspect. Like, what do you really need to know about yourself before you start taking risks and before you start investing? And I actually just heard an interview that you did with Elijah, I think pretty recently, about silver manipulation. And I might like to touch on that as well, because I found that fascinating. I didn't know any of that.
No worries. We can do all that.
All right. So I'm going to do about 5 seconds of silence and then we'll get started.
To commemorate something?
I like a sample.
No, I'm joking. Let's go.
I like a sample for just to reduce noise. So, all right.
Hey, you know what? Trump is in Israel. So maybe 5 minutes of silence, 5 seconds of silence. You never know what's going to happen here.
Because that's where you are, right? So maybe we should mention that as well if it fits in. All right. Here we go. My guest today is Lior Gantz. He is an entrepreneur, a world traveler, financial researcher, and an advisor in many forms to many different types of investors. He's also the president of Wealth Research Group. Hey, Lior, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I first heard about you on another podcast or YouTube channel called Finance and Liberty, and I found your story really fascinating. So I wanted to have a chat with you. My show, obviously, as you can tell from the title, well, I don't want to say it focuses on school. It really focuses on education, and we try to like fill in the holes that school leaves as far as education goes. And one of the biggest holes that I think a young person has in their knowledge by the time they're 16, 17, 18 years old is financial education and entrepreneurial education. And I would think maybe, you know, from your experience doing the consulting that you do and the advising that you do, you've probably found that to be fairly true.
Yeah, no doubt. The education system is at least 200 years behind the times. What they're teaching in schools is not something that has any bearing or value on modern day world. You don't need anything that the elementary school, that the middle schools or the high schools, and that's pretty much globally. I'm talking to you. I've been to about 35 countries. I've seen, you know, how children grow up in all types of environment, and there's basically no difference. All parents have a fixation with, I think it's a social norm, they want their kids to be math geniuses. Like it's important that they know these subjects that nobody except, you know, one or two people in Apple that need to know right. trigonometry to develop the next iPad or whatever. The rest of us, we don't need that kind of specialized information. And that goes for many other subjects. One thing I can say is if the school system taught information that was irrelevant, but they at least taught you how to study, how to learn, how to absorb information, then maybe that would have been a good use of time. That doesn't happen as well. Children grow up and they don't know how to do, you know, very basic skills of summarizing, of making sure that they internalize some of the information. It's all regurgitating information. And then to make matters worse, you put them in this kind of a competitive environment where everyone's the same. And why would you, in the real world, Brett, if I have a question, why would I try to solve it? Why would I not try to hire somebody who knows how to do it? So when you do a test in the school system, 30 people are trying to answer the same question. That's so redundant in a company or in a business.
Right.
You would want to have one person ask, hey, who knows the answer for this? Great, let's move on. this entire thing is up, it's backward. It's one of the reasons why I never continued to study anything past high school.
Yeah, it's interesting. And as somebody who was really interested in teaching himself from a very young age, and now, you know, in your 30s, you've turned around and you're helping a lot of people. Not only combat sort of financial ignorance, but also a kind of financial and financial trends ignorance that is perpetuated by people's exposure to the mainstream media. And what you're talking about there, and what I've said on my show for years, is that school produces, unfortunately, nothing against any of these poor people, but it produces a kind of helplessness where people have to go to financial advisors that they don't even know how to vet properly, and they have to get most of their information about, you know, money trends in the world from the mainstream media. And I would think somebody in your position has to invest a lot of your time undoing mistakes that the people you're trying to help have actually made.
I think the most important thing that parents should teach children, and then practice themselves, obviously, as an example, is how to think accurately. There is so much in the world today that is based on nothing but opinions and guesses and just, you know, theories, very simplistic theories that don't really work. So to give you an example, so many people say something like, okay, the dollar goes up and therefore gold goes down.
Right.
There's not a 100% correlation of that, but still that mantra is being recited every day. But if you really look at the data, it happens about 57% of the time. So there's a 50% chance that it doesn't happen, that they go up together or go down together. This is just one example, Brett, but the idea is people do not think accurately. And you know, what I think is important here is that because you learn to respect some sort of an authority, she comes into the class or he, the teacher, and you have to stand up, you have to sit down and listen for 45 minutes, they become this sort of an expert that you can't challenge. But honestly, so much of what even these guys teach, they don't know if that's true or not. They read it off of the history book. But, you know, history is so much more complex than what it says in the book. So what I think is very important is to create a sort of a wall inside of your mind, Brett, and, you know, put three walls. The external walls have many doors, and those doors are opened when somebody has made himself a legitimate person to allow to enter into your mind. So if somebody doesn't justify why he should take up part of your time and insert ideas into your mind, close that door. You know, you can listen to what he's saying, but do not let it affect you. Do not let it make you act in a sort of in any sort of way. Do not let it affect your emotions or anything like that. You know, be pleasant, be social, be cordial, just listen, maybe learn some of the things that the conventional wisdom thinks, but do not let it enter your mind. If he does have proven his validity, let him enter that door. The second wall has far less walls, and you should only let in the closest confidence that you have, your partners, your immediate family, and I'm not talking parents, I'm talking maybe your wife, your children, people that you trust, not necessarily your parents, because they can give you a lot of old school ideas and which do not work today. So even your parents, you should qualify them. My parents have taught me so many things that are not true. It's in life, you gotta connect with people that are the same level as you are, and that doesn't necessarily mean your parents. I love them, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't mean I should listen to everything they say, especially in my age, right? And then the third wall doesn't have any doors, Brett. Because no one can be allowed in, and that's inside that wall is your ego, and you shouldn't let anything or anyone ever come into that door. That's where you make your final decision about everything, and that's where I think people they do not guard those walls. They allow anything and anyone to come in, pollute it, and just leave wreak havoc on your mind, and just leave it at that, and they're gone from your life.
Yeah, absolutely. That's an interesting visual to use to understand this. And, you know, it's if somebody breaches the first wall that shouldn't, I guess they can get all the way through the doorless wall, right, to your ego and start affecting your emotions. So I think a really important question about that first wall is
just to clarify, Brett. Just to clarify, the first two walls, people should – it's not a breach. Oh, you're meaning if I left it accidentally open to somebody that shouldn't come in. Because I allow people in who make valid claims, and I understand that I should listen to them. But you're saying if I let my guard down and allowed someone who doesn't have any value to my life come in and affect my my abilities. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. So the question was, what's your criteria at that first wall? Like, how do you vet somebody to see if they should continue to move forward and gain access?
Well, I guess the biggest thing is motive.
Yeah.
You got to realize what's the other person's motive. If he's trying to sell something, fine. I don't mind being sold, being pitched. I don't mind people pitching me ideas, people pitching me information. I just want to make sure that I understand the motive. I don't want to allow somebody in on false pretense. So it's very important to understand what people's motives are. Everyone has an angle, a motive. You know, it's a blessed thing. Otherwise, we won't have entrepreneurship. We won't have competition. We won't have capitalism, and you and I will not be talking on Skype because the inventor of Skype wouldn't have been there without the free enterprise system. So we live in a very, very exciting world because most of the planet right now is working on this amazing free enterprise system. Yes, there are troubles. Yes, there are problems. There's everything. But compare this to 200 years ago, and you'll see you're living in a great time. So motive is number one, is the first key. Second thing, I want to know who this person is, right, before I listen to him. So I would ask a few qualifying questions. I'm not talking social here. Friends and everything like that, I listen to wholeheartedly. But when it comes to something that they want to share with me, which I don't think is true or that I don't think they're an expert on, I would ask some qualifying questions.
Right.
And what you want to make sure with your qualifying questions is that you don't give away your agenda, what you're asking. So in other words, if he's saying that he thinks – let's just talk investments for a second. He thinks Apple will be a great company going forward for the next 5 years. So I wouldn't ask him something like, why do you think Apple will be a great company? I will ask him, what do you know about the smartphone industry? A very general question to make sure that I don't give away what I really want to ask him, which is, what do you know about Apple?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So qualifying questions would be a great idea on deciphering whether or not you want to be involved with this person. Just interviewing him and making sure that it's done in a comfortable way, just checking him out is very important. So that's the number one thing for me. I don't care about what he did in the past or not when it comes to previous occupations, etc. I see so many bright minds who do not get any chance or any break, and they're just getting going. So what am I going to say? Hey, you've never had an important role with any company. I'm not going to listen to you. No, not at all. What I want to know is if they're passionate, how much time they spend researching something or understanding something, and how do they come to their conclusions? If this is based on fact, then yeah, definitely I'd love to listen. And honestly, all the best ideas you ever get come from somebody else, right? Where else can they come from? If you're not inspired by an extremely developed imagination, everything you ever come up with will come out of feedback that you get from other people.
Yeah, at least in part, for sure. And I wanted to allow my audience to go through this process we've been describing here with you, right? Because you are pretty well established, but I think most of the people in my audience haven't heard of you before, and this is their introduction. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your background and work up to the work that you do today. There are some things about your history that I think are very impressive. First of all, where did you grow up and go to school?
Israel.
Okay. So the public system, it's a public school system, I assume.
Yeah, it's similar to the U.S., I would reckon.
At this point, yeah, I think most of the, you know, the Western industrial first world countries have adopted what was originally the Prussian school system. So I know that school throughout, you know, many of the countries in Europe, the United States, Canada, Japan, they all look very similar in, you know, their treatment and approach to, quote unquote, educating young people. So, yeah, I don't think we could tell each other too many stories that would be super surprising about our school experiences. Now, you started working at the age of 13, meaning that you were less than half as many years old as many kids are when they start working today, you know, if they're lucky. So what was it at that age? I mean, I'm thinking about myself at that age. I started working when I got a license because I wanted to pay for gas, but that was like, you know, many years later. What inspired you or drove you to start working so young? What were you trying to achieve?
I think it was kind of the same thing like you said right now. You wanted gas, and at 13, I wanted things. And when I saw that I can't get them from getting the money from my parents, I said, okay, well, I just got to figure it out myself. And I started doing the simple work, babysitting, coaching helping to coach basketball with the obviously with an adult, and I was like the assistant. At age 16, I already started delivering pizzas. I did everything, everything you can, and I saved money, which no teenager does, and that's very important. It allowed me to buy a lot of investing courses and fulfill a lot of my dreams very early on. Because I started investing at 16.
Right.
I put my money to work at 16. And you know what? It wasn't a crazy amount, but it started to work and it started to compound. And luckily for me, it was 2001. It was really at the bottom when I was 16 and started to invest. So I got in right at the bottom. Luckily, I invested in China when it was really, really just the early part of the commodities cycle there. I got my parents' approval, obviously, to run my own bank account and as a minor, and started to follow what's going on. Nobody told me to do that, and that is the important point here, Brett. Everyone has their own distinct personality, and what happens in school is because you want to be the same, you're almost fearful to be yourself.
Sure.
And I think it's important for people to understand there is a sacrifice to be made by yourself or by your children when you decide to be your own person. People do not like that. As a general rule, inside of an environment, a summer camp, a vacation, whatever it is, when you inside of a society start to act in your own way, you might experience friction, that's where your personality can come in. If you can develop an attractive personality, even if people see you, you know, doing your own thing, walking your own way, they will not try to challenge you or obstruct you. If you can become flexible with them and be very cordial with what you're doing. But yeah, definitely when some other teenagers my age were, you know, calling me up, can you come here, can you come there, I was doing other things.
Yeah,
I was doing 6 hours or 8 hour shifts delivering pizzas, or I would be reading investment books. There's a lot of things that I had to sacrifice and kind of prioritize in my life, because I wanted to get this early start, and I saw that just by default, what I'm doing is something that nobody else does. So that has got to compound somehow. So that happened early on. And then, I think because it happened so early on, I got really habitualized in controlling my time and enforcing self-discipline. I just didn't see any reason why I would continue to go to study.
Sure.
Academics. I wanted to study something else.
Did you have really well-defined cliques at your school in Israel? It's certainly something.
What's
that,
a clique?
Yeah. I thought this might. I bet once I describe it, it's going to sound familiar. Cliques are like groups that develop around certain identities.
Definitely.
Right. So when you talk about
gangs, like groups.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So the jocks is one, or you know, the emos, or the nerds.
I think it's part of human nature. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. We had those. I actually I'm 6'4", so I played basketball throughout high school, and I was at the team. So I wouldn't say I was part of the jocks per se, but definitely, you know, not on the sidelines or in the fringe or anything like that.
Yeah, I bring that up because you talk about this apprehension that people have to be their own person. Because of the environment, I think, in school, there is a hesitation to do that. But everybody has that drive. I mean, school crushes it in a lot of ways, but people have that desire to be their own person, but they also have this fear about doing it. So the cliques in school allow, like, people to find support groups, right, for showcasing some kind of identity as long as it's safe to do it. You know, that other people are doing it. But what's interesting is, at least in many aspects of your life, you're carving out this path that nobody else is doing. And I'm wondering, like, what kind of friction you encountered. It was probably, I mean, there's a lot of value in finding a mentor for what you were trying to do or what you were exploring. That was probably a challenge. So if you want to talk a little bit about both of those things, because that would be the advice that I would have for you know, a young entrepreneur who is, you know, trying to do these things at an age where it is really, really like the ideal time in life to fail, because, you know, your only responsibility, I guess, is like cleaning your room and maybe mowing the lawn, right? There's a roof over your head. There's food in the fridge. You don't have to worry about these things. So this is a great opportunity to take risks, but it doesn't mean that those risks are going to be without friction, without failure. And, you know, it's hard when you're in the school environment to also find people to support and mentor you through those new kinds of explorations. So speak to any or all of that, if you like.
Yeah, the first thing I would say is, look, to succeed, you got to man up and you got to go and execute. And it's that simple. It's that simple, but it's that hard. So it's all about commitment. And I've mentally made the decision to commit to the life that I want to live. And, you know, my parents, throughout this entire time, even in my adult life, have always begged me to get a degree.
Sure.
And they just get a degree. It's a parachute or whatever the other names for it is. My grandmother, God bless her soul, died last November, 89 years old. Until her last day, she said, could you please just go to uni? it doesn't matter to them. It didn't matter to them that my income level is probably 12 times what all of the peer group is making, or you know, all of our other grandchildren. It doesn't matter. She doesn't see that. It's fixated within this generation, the previous generation, definitely the previous, that university is a must stepping stone. They're not part of the new world, the new business world. And the new business world is very niched, Brett. You got to find a very specific topic that you can excel in far and above anybody else. Understand your client completely, how they think and what they want, and provide value to them. And the rest is nothing. Consider Intel. They do one thing, chips.
Mm-hmm.
They don't try to divert to anything else. Consider Donna Karan. She makes women's suits for businesswomen. That's her specialty. You know, you got to clearly define what you want to do and make sure that you really understand your customer. And that's where this starts. Then you can, if you lack resources, people will get attracted to you and you can raise money. If you lack other specialties, marketing, sales, administrative, whatever, there are, you know, professionals that will help you with that. You have to be a generalist and not a specialist if you want to build a business today. If you want to become an employee, or you think the best way for you is to start as an employee, learn the ropes, you know, get more equated with the business environment, and then move to business. I will say this: it's very addictive to become an employee.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And there's lots of comfort in doing that, and I completely understand You know, anybody who does it, as long as they don't go on to, you know, permanently hate their existence as a result of it. But I have lots of friends who are employees, and they really get a lot of satisfaction and security from their work. And that is something that I do miss sometimes. You know, doing what I do now is the security that, you know, having a job, a teaching job, used to offer. Unfortunately, the ceiling for income was, you know, a bigger downside than the upside of the securities that the job provided. But you mentioned finding a niche, and we've talked about, you know, you starting work at 13, starting investing at 16. When did you start a business, and what was your process like as a young man for finding a niche? Like, how did you go about doing that? Because it's a big decision to make. And there's probably a lot of really essential considerations that go into that.
Sure. I made the ultimate mistakes starting out. And, you know, some of the big business mistakes that I see, you know, all the time, and I see them with people everywhere. The biggest mistake is trying to create a patent, thinking that the best business is to be completely unique. And so what I said is, you know what, why don't people do this? This is much better. And I looked to create products or to import products that people do not use in Israel per se. Or when I started my first businesses in the US, I said, okay, why don't people do it this way? This is a much better way. And what I did was ask the wrong question. The wrong business question is, what do people need? Because people don't do what they need to do. If people did what they needed to do, then all people will be fit, healthy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the business is not about making products that people need. You know, in the I'm not using the common sense of the world, the word need. Need meaning that this is what they should do.
Right, okay, sure, yeah.
Yeah, so people don't do what they should do, and therefore products that help them do what they should do don't always work. What you want to find is what people want. You want to solve their problems the easiest way possible. And therefore, these are the things that really work over time. And they're not hard to find. All you need to do is to develop an enhancement to an existing product, and this is something very important. To give you an example of this, a friend of mine wanted to import a product which makes water, drinking water from humidity. So humidity condenses, and then it becomes water if cooled, right?
Mm-hmm.
So and there's humidity all over all over Israel because it's right near the Mediterranean, and so you can get fresh water after you have some cleaning devices cleaned within this machine, and you would set it in your kitchen, and it will be your house water device. Excellent, everybody needs that, right? It's for a fraction of the cost of mineral water. All the filters inside give the water minerals. On the surface of this, it was an amazing thing. The only problem was that its cost was $1,300 up front, as
right.
opposed to other products that were about $400 up front. But then you need to change a filter for like $100 every 6 months. But people don't factor that in. They should. They should think about how much this would cost 5 years from now. And they would see that the $1,300 one time, and then you get water for free for the rest of your life because it comes out of the air, is a much better deal. But the fact is, what they want is to pay $400 and then pay $100 every 6 months for the filter.
Yeah, interesting. Well, it sounds like what people want is clean, drinkable water, which
for sure.
is something that you could have for, you know, here anyway, $25 at Walmart. You go and you buy a Brita pitcher, right?
Yeah.
So then I guess there's a question of like, what's the advantage of spending that extra money? But yeah, I understand what you're saying. I think that one of the things, or one of the trends in business is that people also don't understand trends, you know, and you see, like in America, a lot of the people who became tycoons of the railroad industry in the late 1800s and early 1900s, they convinced themselves that they were in the railroad business, that what people wanted was to ride around on trains. What people actually wanted was to go places. And when they were offered a better way to do that, a way that offered them more freedom via the automobile, the train people didn't catch on to that and they didn't adapt. And a lot of them died with you know, greatly diminished fortunes. And in some cases, they died with nothing because they said people need trains if they want to go places. And they, I think a lot of that is emotional too. Like they refuse to accept changing trends.
Yes. I think that's very true, and it's something that you gotta be on top of all the time. The market zigs, the market zags, and people want one thing one day and another thing another day, and you've gotta really make sure that you deliver. That is the unselfish part of business. Mm-hmm. The people who are self-centered cannot be very successful in business because what they think they always think they are right, and they always think, "Hey, you know, people need this. This will work. People need this." And when people do not want to buy what they offer, they take it personally instead of trying to see what's going on. So this is some, part of the mistakes that I did early on. But then I made sure that I stopped that. I started to streamline and find things that you know, are profitable and are proven, and tap into those. And that's where I started to experience a much greater success.
So you didn't care if you were first to market with something. That's a mistake to avoid as far as you're concerned, is trying to find this thing that's completely unique, even if, you know, like people would say, well, no one's ever come to market with anything like this before. And it sounds like the water out of humidity was an example of somebody favoring uniqueness over practicality and not understanding that the lack of practicality would make it almost unsellable on a large scale.
Well, I would say this. The first to market is very powerful. What he didn't understand is that you need first to market and you need the trend. You need the trends. You need to see what people want. That device, to me, did not work because it was large. It was high. You couldn't set it on the sink. And I think at that point, people wanted sink countertop, smaller, more aesthetic. They spent $20,000 on a kitchen, which is what kitchens cost in Israel because people love their islands and marbles and all that. So they don't want a sluggish-looking machine in their kitchen. They want a very sexy machine. Mm-hmm. And another company picked up on that. The consumer and retail are by far two of the it's the most lucrative one. Look at history. You'll see that consumer products have made the most fortunes for people. IKEA, look at Apple, look at Walmart. You know, the Waltons are the richest family on the planet right now. So retail is very, very profitable and lucrative, but you need to really be on pulse. It's a dynamic and changing industry. It's not those types of industries that Warren Buffett likes to invest in where they'll be the same tomorrow and the same the next day, etc.
Indeed. So a lot of people in my audience are interested in this idea of the solopreneur, which is, it's not exactly what I do. I've had to bring in people to help me, but for a long time what I do, I was the only person doing it. And I was very much a generalist. I had to do everything. So there is that appeal, and there is a kind of freedom and autonomy in being a solopreneur. But in addition to having the right product, I've heard you talk a lot about having the right partners, that you often wouldn't want to go into a new venture alone. You want to find the right people. And I think maybe like having the right kind of brain trust or mastermind could prevent some of these disasters, bad decisions or business failures.
I would never go into business alone. Never.
Yeah. So talk about that a little bit. Why not? Have you ever tried?
I have. I think the most important thing in business is having a partner.
Yeah.
By far. It's superior to anything else because that power can out-trump anything. Any failure, any setback, any obstacle. And you've got to have a partner who is legit with you, and you're legit with him, and you can exchange ideas and come up with plans together. If you think this is wrong, there is no successful person in history who's done it alone. There isn't. Even Michelangelo had partners in the painting business. People that are superior singers have vocal coaches. You've got to have two or three or whatever, even one person that you can share everything with on the business level. And a famous story, by the way, is that Bill Gates sat down with five people to pitch them Microsoft, five classmates, and two of them went with them, and three of them are seeing shrinks. So
right.
The rest is history, right? Two of them are I think one of them is like the fifth or sixth most the richest person in the world. The thing is, the reason that they're so important is because you can share everything with them. And when your emotional game set, game plan is not right, that's exactly what you want to do. You want to share that, share your weaknesses, release that tension, and have somebody else put that in perspective for you. And if you don't have that, I think you're missing out on a lot of the fun that business, that building a business has to offer. And, you know, when determining a partner and who should be your partner, do not look for friends or family as a default. There is a very specific type of partner that you want. You want somebody who is actually qualified to do what you want him to do. You don't want to just a partner just for the sake of it. That will not provide leverage to your business. That will not help you.
Right.
What you want is someone who can act with confidence, who can be understanding, who can act fairly and with courage when you need that. And that's exactly the power behind partnerships. And Brett, just some of the things that they teach you in school, going back to school here, is not to copy from somebody who's sitting right next to you and he knows the answer, and not to share. But that's exactly the opposite of what you want to do in business, because the fact is, in life, in anything that you do, you want to create partnerships. You want to create a partnership in your marriage. You want to create a partnership with yourself and not beat yourself up. You want to create a partnerships with mentors, and it goes on and on. The more partnerships, the more relationships you can have, the better you will be skilled in life, and you will just live a better existence. Life will be more fun for you if you have good relationships.
Absolutely. That's I totally agree with that. So how involved is your process for assessing the strengths or the potential liabilities of people you might partner with?
I've had the fortune of finding the ideal partner for me. The most important thing in order to really find the right person is to be as brutally honest and direct and forthcoming with him or her the second you meet her. And look, in business, I found that if you play games, then you'll get burned. And it's just not worth it. I see that every day. People go to meetings and introductions with this sort of a defense game on. They don't want to reveal their weaknesses. They don't want to reveal what's going on. And that's fine. And that's good. That's part of business. But there's a point where you got to be flexible and show the other person your passions and your values. Because if you don't show them yours and you don't see theirs, you'll never know if there's a connection.
Absolutely. Well said. Hey, I want to be respectful of your time, but can you hang around for like 20 more minutes? Is that possible? Like till 10 past the hour? That's awesome. Because I want to transition back to investing. And one of the other things that I liked that I heard you talk about was this philosophy of stoicism, where you didn't use those words, but it reminds me of the Stoic philosophy, where one of the ways of being able to move forward, to not get paralyzed by fear, is to basically conjure up in your mind and confront the worst case scenario. of, you know, a certain course of action. And you've talked about, you know, reason versus emotion in investing. And you also talk about it in the mission statement on your website for Wealth Research Group. So I'd like you to just, you know, open up and share the thoughts about distinguishing between emotion and reason, or the interplay between the two when it comes to investing.
Sure. I think investing has a lot to do with self-discipline. And the reason that this is so is because, you know, most people, and this will be quite a shock for most listeners, most people think that the money in investing is made on appreciation of gain, appreciation of price. Mm-hmm. So most people think that when you buy a company, you buy a stock of a company, the best way to profit is for the company to gain in price. And historically, that has only been 30% of stock market profits throughout history. More profits are made by collecting dividends and by the company buying its own shares and reducing the amount of outstanding shares, so the company is valued more. There's much to this. The same thing goes in real estate. Most people want to buy a house and see its price go up. And historically, that's not where you make money in real estate. You make money by collecting rents. And there's other niches. But the idea is that cash flow is much more important at investing than price appreciation, because obviously for prices to gain, that means that everyone has to be richer in order to afford this new price level. And obviously that cannot be the case. The world does not become richer and richer every day in a straight linear line. It's very cyclical. So this requires a lot of self-discipline, because prices go up and down every day. And now with the fact that people are actually looking at computer screens 24/7, it's insane. Then you see prices fluctuate all day long. The thing that you want to make sure with investing is you want to kind of unattach yourself from noises. Noises are these daily fluctuations in price. You got to realize that a stock price is so dumb in the intraday moves, Brett. Take a company like Apple. Mm-hmm. The company is worth like $700 billion. Mm-hmm. If it moves down by 1%, that means $7 billion worth of value, you know, disappeared from the company. Is there any reason why that would happen on a given day? Did something happen to Apple today or tomorrow that would raise their value by $7 billion or lower it by $7 billion? Well, it has to be a very unique thing. But $7 billion every day for Apple is quite frequent, that they move up or down for in 1%.
Right, because we're talking about the worth of the entire operation. So to lose $7 billion, you know, did a warehouse burn down? Did a bunch of their, you know, planes crash into each other? Something like that would come to mind. But when we don't see, you know, something so clearly and tangibly catastrophic happening day in and day out, yeah, you would start to question what that 1% dip actually means in the real world.
Right, and when you own when you own shares of companies, you are ownership. You are a fractional owner. You're part of the ownership, and so that means that let's say you own a pizza place, and the pizza place is worth $1 million. And do you think every day you would say, hey, you know what, my business is not worth $1 million today? Today I think it's worth 1% less, so I think it's worth $990,000. Why would you say that? Why would you move the value of your business every day in such a level? You would not do that, right?
Right, right.
And so these are the emotions, the everyday emotions of the marketplace, and you have to reason them out. You have to see if you want to subscribe to that theory that companies should be 1 or 2% higher or lower just because somebody else thinks that, and that's what the market is. It's just somebody else thinking that. So we should go back to the first thing I said, which is thinking accurately and asking myself, who are these other people that are thinking that? Are they more qualified than me? Do they know more than me about what's going on? And then you need to reason these things out. And when you do that, you would see that most of the time at investing, you need to use reason and not emotions. Now, emotions should not be blocked out. Definitely not. They have an important energy, and they're very critical for success. And let me give you the real reason why you want to use your emotions. When the market is tanking, when the market is correcting severely, and everybody else is selling, you need to use your emotions to get excited and enthusiastic, because there are so many instances where nothing fundamental has happened to a company that you like, and now you can buy it for 30 or 40% less. To give you an example of this, you can go back to the Great Recession, and you can look at the price, at the share price of companies like Intel, Microsoft, McDonald's, that went down substantially, and the actual underlying company was more profitable in 2008 than in 2007. They were more profitable in 2009 than 2008. So you are looking at a company that is growing and that is cheaper. What else would you want? But if you don't get excited by that, if you block your emotions and become indifferent, then you would lose the opportunity of a lifetime, basically, to buy these companies when they were so depressed in valuations and at great prices. So investing has to do with two things: emotions and reason. And you have to weigh out which one will determine your decision that day. And that is the function of your ego, to say, okay, what am I going to allow to dictate my decisions today? So to give you another example of this, if you remember 1987, you had Black Monday in October.
Yes.
And Coca-Cola shares were tanking. Now, I can't attest to this because I was 4 years old, 3 years old, but I believe that in Omaha, Nebraska, in the office of Warren Buffett, they were opening champagne bottles while they were buying shares of Coca-Cola on the cheap. In fact, the CEO of Coca-Cola called Warren and asked him if he was the one bidding all these shares, and just to understand how successful that trade was. If you take what he invested in 1987. In Coca-Cola, and he never sold any shares from that point on. He receives in dividend payments every year 50% of his original investment.
Yeah.
That would be equated to buying a house in 1987 for $1 million and today collecting $500,000 every year in rents.
Yeah, absolutely.
The idea here is that investing revolves around these two things. And obviously, behind all that is the idea that you've got to look at what is proven to work, Brett. And you know, I want to encourage people to read, you know, Tony Robbins?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So he wrote a fantastic book. It's basically 52 interviews that he conducted with 52 billionaires. And it's called Money Master the Game. A very thick book, just released. But in that book, he paid a lot of money to do a study about money managers, and 94%, you ready for this? 94% of money managers cannot outperform the S&P 500.
And what does that mean exactly for the novice?
For the novice, if you're looking to invest money,
yeah,
you're probably saying to yourself, hey, I don't know anything about investing. I should get a money manager, pay him a fee.
Right.
He should run my investments. Well, what they're telling you is, 94 out of every 100 people that call themselves a money manager or a financial advisor will end up costing you a fortune. If the only thing you do in your life is invest in the S&P 500, in the 500 most important companies of the U.S. economy, you would do better than 94% of the paid, I wouldn't say whores, but of the paid suits and Wall Street charging you a fee.
But most people wouldn't have the courage or the knowledge to do that on their own.
And that's what Wealth Research Group was founded for. We founded the company in 2016, the early goings in January 2016, exactly for that fact. The Wealth Research Group is a free financial newsletter. It was ranked number one in the world for 2016. Hopefully, this will continue 2017. But the idea is to strengthen your financial fortress, to make sure that you're ready to take action because you're that level of certainty with yourself. And so many people are just paranoid about investing, which they shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of umbrella that the Wealth Research Group provides. You know, with everything that we do on the website, you've got two great tabs on the homepage. One is called Special Reports, and the other is called Wealth Stocks, and that's our download reports, and that's where you can come in and download and learn so much information. You got the newsletter, which extensively covers a lot of ideas, but it goes on the big picture, and you can learn details, and you can learn about a lot of basic stuff. And you got the YouTube channel with all the interviews that we conduct. So that's kind of the scope and the umbrella. And the added value is that we do due diligence periods where we go on a 40 or a 50-day marathon, and we look at specific companies, specific stocks that are very under the radar. You won't have heard of any of them on your own. These are not your big companies. These are small cap companies that we think have a huge potential. And when we find something very captivating, we suggest that. We put that information out there. We publish it to members of our free newsletter.
Excellent. You know, one of the things that I've heard you talk about in your interviews and on your site to a certain extent is crisis preparation. And I think there's a lot of people in my audience. There's a lot of libertarian and Austrian school people who listen to my show. And at this point, you know, I hate to say it, but it almost sounds like a bit of a broken record. We've been hearing the same doom and gloom stories about the U.S. economy or the collapse of fiat currency now for 10 years. And it's almost like
46 years.
Well, I mean, we've been doing I've been involved for about 10 years. So I've been hearing it for 10 years.
Oh, okay.
But you're right. Yeah, the story goes back to Nixon, at least. You know, I don't want to push that aside and say, oh, I guess that's just never really going to happen and things can just keep going this way. And, you know, at times I'm frustrated by, you know, I look at my situation and I say, I'm a little bit behind where I'd like to be right now as far as savings and investments. And I did leave, you know, a secure, much higher paying job for what I do now and what I'm trying to build now. But when I think about the situation that most people just in the U.S. are in, it's actually kind of terrifying. I've heard the statistic that about 80% of people have less than $5,000 in savings. And if you think about that in the context of some kind of economic collapse, that is quite frightening, the panic and the desperation that could develop in this country very, very quickly. So that would be a very important consideration in crisis preparation. When you think about, you know, crisis preparation or surviving something catastrophic like that, what are your most concrete pieces of advice?
Sure. Let me start the answer with something to keep in mind. Historically, there have been crisis situations throughout history. It's part of nature. It's as natural as a thunderstorm. It's part of the market to correct overvaluations and undervaluations. Sometimes it's very severe. With regards to what you're talking about, which is a monetary crisis, where the system that issues currency or credit that we're operating on, which is called the fiat monetary system, it's a global system. And therefore, the crisis that can happen is a global crisis, and that has never happened in history. The world has never been global. You've had a situation in the 1300s, for instance, where Venice was today's New York. And so all the banking activities happened there. And one time, some of the banks had crashed because of they issued credit more than they had gold in their vaults. And you had a really rough situation in Europe. And it trickled to a bunch of countries in Europe. But today what can happen is a global situation. And that's where the problem is. And that's where you hear a lot of gloom and doom information for years.
Yeah, there's precedent for that, too. I mean, we have a far less globalized world in the 1930s, but the Great Depression definitely rippled out to Europe. It had an effect on Germany, for sure, which was one of the causes of World War II. So there's the stage is set, and I think it's understood that the world is far more globalized today, and even one of those collapses would have a ripple effect that would be far more significant.
Sure. And that's why you should have crisis hedges, and I'll talk about them. But I think what's the key mistake of many of the gloom and doomers is that they think that they will get rich by the crisis. So they're almost hoping that there will be a global crisis because they think that will help them win. And it's important to understand that throughout history, you can make a lot of money in crisis situations, but it's not something that happens every day. So to look at data and to always say, hey, there's going to be a crisis, there's going to be a crisis, that will get you very frustrated and that will get you in the wrong type of investments. Most of the time, the economy is moving along, chugging along. We've had two world wars in the 20th century. We've had the Korean War, Vietnam War. We had pandemics, oil shocks, famines. You know what? We had terrorist attacks. What did we not have? But the fact of the matter is that publicly traded companies, stocks, have compounded throughout that time at an 8% rate. Mm. And just to give you an idea, even if you were just an average guy, an average Joe in the 50s, smoking your Marlboro cigarettes, and instead of smoking a pack, you would invest in the Philip Morris company, you would have made more money than Warren Buffett. The Philip Morris company is the most profitable company of the 20th century, the maker of Marlboro. Whether or not it's ethical or not to invest in cigarettes, it's another issue. But the idea I'm trying to convey here is that throughout that period, throughout that 50-year period, if you only done one thing, you only purchase Philip Morris stock every month, you would have made more money than a guy sitting 8 hours a day in his office reading all of the financial newsletters and newspapers in the world and having an IQ far superior to any other investor in history. Mm. So public companies are a very important part of making a killing investing. And chaos hedges are very important as part of what you're doing. No matter how right you think you are, you must have some sort of insurance policy for if you're wrong. That's part of being a good investor. And so some people hedge, some people short, some people do other ways. The best way to insure yourself is called asset allocation, where you basically do not have 100% of your funds in one idea or even one asset class. And so if you ask me personally, what I have, first of all, is called a cash emergency fund. And that is cash outside the banking system. It's cash that I have with me. And I have 12 months worth of expenses with me. So if there's something severe, incredibly severe, I have cash outside the banking system. I've seen what happened. I was in Greece when the crisis happened there. Oh, I saw 75-year-old people, baked in the sun, looking to cash money out of their ADM, and the thing is closed, and all the young people are able to stand in line. Well, they have to sit on the pavement, and they can't get in. I saw Cyprus and what happened there. These are recent European countries. I was in the U.S. when 2008 happened. So these things happen, and you should just prepare for them. It doesn't matter if you have 12 months worth of expenses in the bank or outside the bank, right? So you need to have some savings, right, as part of your life. So why not have them outside the banking system? So that's one thing that's important.
So before we go on to the next one, I just want to talk a little bit, unless this is, I mean, we might be transitioning to it right now, but a lot of people hear, you know, this cash or 12 months of cash, but we also think about currency devaluation. So I guess, you know, how much would precious metals be a part of that crisis insurance as a, you know, as a store of value?
Well, that's the next phase here.
Okay, and great, just, great.
And just important to understand, Brett, you know, when you see currency devaluing, right now inflation is about a 3 or 4% unofficial. The official rate of inflation is about 2.5%. But you know, the government lies, obviously. So let's use 3 or 4%. That is not something that you want to transition all your cash to precious metals for. This is not a great bargain. Precious metals can also go down much more than 3 or 4% in 1 year. They're very volatile in a fiat monetary system. So that's the first thing you want. Now, other things you want is an allocation into physical precious metals. Sure, throughout history, gold and silver have been used as money more than any other material, more than any other commodity. You know, people have used tea, grains, you know, even tulips were used.
Salt,
Anything and everything. Silk was used for many, many years as money. I mean, there's all sorts of things. But historically, the human race has used gold and silver as money more than anything else. So it's very wise and astute to own some. Now, there are people who own 50% of their wealth in precious metals, and you gotta remember, it's a piece of metal. So if you're looking to get rich from that, you're probably not gonna do it. It's nobody gets rich from taking out 10 insurance policies on his car.
Right.
Is what I mean. So an allocation of 4 to 10% is enough at this point. If you see something that is accelerating and, you know, becoming more severe, then increase that. Now, the fear is that everybody says, hey, well, you know what? If everyone does that at the same time, there won't be any gold and silver left. Honestly, there's a lot of it. You know, any ounce of gold that has ever been mined is above ground. Silver, not so much. It's an industrial metal. The stockpiles are all but gone today. We're in deficit. So if you don't have any silver, this will be a good time to go out and get a few ounces of silver. And one of the good things you can do is store them in a few locations within the U.S. or even outside. I have my gold holdings in Hong Kong, in Canada, in South America, in the U.S., and in Switzerland. So I have a few vaults that I rent in these areas. So it's always good to politically diversify as well.
Yeah.
The new thing that has come on just recently is the cryptocurrencies. The beauty about them is that they're outside the system. So, you know, they can't get confiscated. They can't get manipulated. They're the perfect capitalism. They're worth what other people say that they're worth. So, having an allocation in that has been very, very profitable. Just as a speculation, has been very profitable. I mean, Wealth Research Group, we talked about Bitcoin a year and a half ago. We talked about Ethereum, Monero, Stimmit. You know, so many subscribers are up 500, 600, 700% on these cryptocurrencies.
Yep.
That it's you know, it's been the most lucrative trade of the last 3 years, bar none.
Yeah.
And so having some funds allocated into that is very important. And these are my highest conviction chaos hedges. Now, if you want to do more than that, you can own foreign real estate. Foreign real estate is rarely confiscated by the government. You know, I've seen really no instances that governments go out and try to, you know, nationalize foreign real estate. It's a very safe investment to make.
I would think the safety would vary from place to place, though.
Of course. I'm not talking about buying a single family house in the middle of Africa. I'm talking about owning it in a Western society where things are chugging along. These are a few of the chaos edges. Another chaos edge, which is, you know, I can get into because it's a little bit more complex. There's a few products that are very, very exciting in the life insurance industry where you can have your cash very secure, even bearing interest, Brett, which is, you know, something we do not have in this day and age, and have your family secured, your own life secured, and have a lot of cash at hand. Subscribers to Wealth Research Group can hear more about that in the newsletter where we talk about this, and I'm going to issue a special or an exclusive PDF report with my two favorite products in the life insurance industry next month. So definitely be on the lookout for that if you're a subscriber on, or go to the website next month to download the file. So that's with regards to chaos hedges. Now, if you think that fiat currencies are going to erode, which is my personal opinion, and if you think the dollar is ending its superiority as a reserve currency, which is my opinion, then gold and silver companies, stocks, or commodity stocks is something that you don't want to miss out on. And I don't want to insult anybody in the audience, obviously, but and I want to make sure that you don't get upset. But I also believe wholeheartedly that the marijuana legalization process that is going on right now in the U.S. is going to create fortunes as well for investors. And the beauty about that is that the small-time investors, and not big pharma or big tobacco or big liquor, we can make more money than them because it's federally still illegal. And so they cannot get in to some of the things regulatory-wise that we can invest in. And so that's also something concentrate on Wealth Research Group as well.
Yeah, I don't think you're offending anyone in my audience with that suggestion. But, you know, you're talking about right now there's this opportunity for the small investor. And it reminds me, you know, when it comes to precious metals, especially silver, I think a lot of people who know the history are aware of, who were they? The Hunt brothers in the early 70s, yeah, who tried to corner the silver market.
The late.
Yeah, well,
the
that
late
was
70s. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So small-time operation compared to the people who are manipulating that market today, like J.P. Morgan and Deutsche Bank and HSBC. Mm-hmm. Sure. And, you know, so a lot of us who were, you know, very interested in this idea, or even somewhat fearful about the idea of currency collapse in the United States, we were investing in silver over the course of the last 10 years. And initially we were excited, not really, I guess investment is the wrong word, but as a store of value, as an insurance policy, when, you sure. know, just 5-6 years ago, silver was around $30, $35 an ounce. And now it's dipped mm-hmm. to about half that. And it's been there consistently. And mm-hmm. I always thought, very naively, I thought that there was some kind of purity or uncorruptibility about precious metals. But there's all kinds of shenanigans going on in the silver
definitely.
Market right now. And just first of all, thank you so much for the extra time that you've given me. But can I just ask you about that and like what considerations people should have about price suppression or silver manipulation generally?
What you got to realize about silver and just about price manipulation as a whole. Price manipulation is like taking a volleyball and shoving it underwater. Now, you can hold that thing underwater for a long time, but at some point, when you release, that thing pops.
Right.
And so, obviously, it's very upsetting and frustrating when you see your investment crater from 30-something to 16, 17 today, dollars per ounce. But here's the thing. If you want to accumulate precious metals as a store of value, then you got to look at the long-term view. And on the long-term view, as long as the COMEX in London and in New York, the commodity exchanges are leveraged about 233-1 today. So for every physical 1 ounce of silver, 233 contracts of paper silver are being traded every day. Mm. It's insane. And it's not something that can go on forever. Whether or not it can go on for another 5 to 10 years, it might. It might. The banks have a lot of power under a fiat monetary system because they can issue credit. But the idea is if you're accumulating physical silver, you want to accumulate it on the cheap. And so what they're doing is basically they're helping you if you want to have a overweight of silver accumulation in your portfolio, they're helping you. What they're not helping are the silver stocks, which obviously because the price it's low, then their profitability, their bottom lines are just not there. So some of the companies, they need to make sure that they're profitable at these rates, at these prices. And it's very hard to build a mine for an all-in cost of less than $17.
Yeah.
So what you're seeing is a situation where to accumulate physical server is a very good thing. You want to accumulate something which is cheap, correct?
Yeah.
But when you invest in silver companies or in gold companies, these companies, as opposed to what I talked with before about dividends, these companies do not issue dividends. Most of them do not make any money. The way you this is not an investment. A gold or a silver or a commodity company is more of a speculation than an investment. What you're speculating on is that the people behind the company, the management, the leadership, can turn the cash burn rate of finding a deposit, permitting it, developing it, making it a mine at a lesser cost than what it cost them to raise the money to build the company.
Right.
And that is a speculation. That's why you got to stick to the people who already done it, who know what they're, who know how to do this. And by the way, Brett, for your listeners, I created two special reports on this topic. One is exactly how to evaluate and conduct the diligence on these kind of companies. And that's on wealthresearchgroup.com/gold playbook. And the second thing is, if you want to look at the companies that we look at, basically create a watch list for yourself of the quality companies to be checking out in this industry, then go to wealthresearchgroup.com/watch list and download exactly the companies that Wealth Research Group, or part of the companies the Wealth Research Group, is evaluating ourselves.
Right.
But to get back to what I'm saying here, the idea is to understand that these small companies are a leveraged play on price appreciation of precious metals. And as long as the S&P 500 is trending up, as it has in the last 8 years, it's very counterproductive for these companies. Most institutional investors go long the S&P 500 and hedge that bet by going short gold and silver companies. So you're seeing a lot of selling pressure in these companies as well. Once that trend reverses, which is something that I believe will happen in the next year to 18 months, where the S&P 500 will start correcting, and I think very severely, correcting about 20-30% down, all of these short positions will have to be liquidated, and you will see gold and silver and commodity companies fly like you've never seen them fly. Now, again, this has not happened in the last 8 years, and you can scream gloom and doom all you want, but as long as the average guy is making money on the S&P 500, gold and silver companies will not soar.
Once that trend
becomes exhausted, which it's starting to right now, but people are not dumping the S&P 500 to go long gold stocks. What they're doing right now is dumping the S&P 500 to go long emerging markets and European shares, which are cheap. And that's why I'm saying in 1 year, when the entire global stock markets, anywhere in the world that you look at, is not attractive, some kind of an event, Brett, we never know what kind of event this is. It can be a conflict in Russia. It can be an oil crisis. It doesn't matter.
Right.
Emotions take over and panic selling begins and a bear market commences, and then you'll see these things fly. Historically, gold and silver companies have flourished when the S&P 500 is underperforming. And in a time when there's either negative or declining interest rates. And so, look at what we're experiencing right now. The Fed is raising rates, and that's not perfect for these companies. That's why they're not soaring, even though the national debt is $20 trillion, and all of these things that people say. True, but it's not enough. It's not how the world works. And it goes back to what we were saying, that people always think, hey, this should be happening, right? Mm. This should be happening. But it's just not what historically has happened. So there's no reason to think that it will start right now. The brilliance of this is that gold and silver stocks are absolutely cheap. Historically, last year, January 2016, when we started the Wealth Research Group, it was the historical low for gold and silver stocks going back to World War II. And that's why we made 12 recommendations, and they all doubled. Some of them went to 300-400%. That has not been the case this year. The trend is not as strong this year. And so right now, what we're doing is accumulating cheap companies on weakness and expecting that these positions will flourish in about a year to a year and a half. Now, there are specialty situations where you see companies that have everything going for them, and they're in the middle of a drilling program.
Yeah.
And drilling programs are, you know, if you find a deposit, it doesn't matter what's going on right now in the economy. When you find the dirt, the sand that you were standing on has minerals in it, the company overnight changes its value. So it just, and that's part of speculation, obviously, Brad. And that's why we recommend that would not be the largest part of your asset allocation. This should be your play money, your speculation money, maybe 10, maybe 15%. Most of your investable income should always be in cash flowing assets. That is what has worked throughout millennia.
Things that can be producing money while you hold them for you.
Sure.
And banking on appreciation somewhere down the road. I gotcha.
Yes. Yes. The historically, the best performing assets of all time, going back to 1812. So you got 105 years of research here. Historically, stocks that pay dividends, that are able to raise their dividends every year, have been the top performing assets anywhere in the world. And you know, to make this even better for you, we have four of these companies featured on the website on the Wealth Stocks tab. You can download our research into four of these companies. They're called Dividend Aristocrats, Brett, and these are companies that are able to raise their dividends every year consecutively for over 25 years. So it's very exciting.
Yeah, and these are, I just want to be clear, these are things that people can get for free on your website. You want people on your mailing list for sure, and that's how they can obtain these things, correct?
Yeah, the download reports are free. You obviously, once you opt in for a download report, you're part of the you're part of the family, part of the community. You get involved with the you get the 365 Wealth newsletter, which is where I email all of our top and highest convictions ideas. And obviously you can unsubscribe at any time. Think of it as a test drive more than anything else. The reason that we found the Wealth Research Group was because I was a money manager from 2009 until 2013 for high net worth clients. And I wanted to reach a broader audience. I wanted to reach the person who doesn't have investable income to the tune of $5 to $10 million. I wanted to reach people that are looking to swim in the water and not drown in them. You understand what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
That was my passion, and that was my partner's passion. That's why we built this company. We wanted to make sure that we do whatever we can as human beings to help other investors and savers to understand what works and what doesn't work, and how to inspire them to make that balance between reason and emotions.
Right. So it's like a leveler playing field without some crappy government program trying to achieve it that fails anyway. Right. It's like a real level.
Yes.
Yeah. I like that. All right. Well, I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate hearing your story from, you know, very young and modest beginnings right up to the present day. And maybe even I think we went 18 months into the future there. So thank you so much, Lior. Great conversation. I learned a lot.
Thank you, Brett, for having me.